You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio, and I'm James Whitmore, coming to you from beautiful Wurundjeri country here in Nam, Melbourne. And I acknowledge the custodians of Sea Country here in Victoria and around Australia. This week on Out of the Blue, the latest on the catastrophic algal bloom that is killing marine life in South Australia. More after this.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are. At home, work, driving.
On public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. Since early this year, marine life has been washing ashore dead in South Australia, and over the following months it has got worse and worse, and now in winter it's still going. Thousands and thousands of dead fish, sea dragons, rays, sharks, seashells and other species have been recorded on beaches, but there are many more that haven't washed up. The cause is a bloom of a type of algae called a dinoflagellate, which damages the gills of fish, mollusks and other marine species. Scientists have warned that this is a catastrophe that will have impacts on people and marine life, possibly for decades. Faith Coleman is an ecological consultant in South Australia who is one of the scientists racing to understand this disaster. I spoke with Faith to get the latest.
Hi, Faith. Thanks so much for joining us on Out of the Blue. Can you tell us what's the latest on this catastrophe? Recently, we've seen reports of fish dying close to Adelaide, as well as, I believe, a great white shark washing ashore.
Yeah, well, it's really been quite incredible. We're watching this bloom, which is a species called Carinia micimotoi, is the dominant species, but there's lots of other species in the bloom because nothing ever exists as a monoculture in the environment. But at the moment, the impacted coastlines seem to stretch from Robe in the southeast of South Australia all the way, and now we're getting reports at Tumby Bay and Port Hughes, so over in the Spencer Gulf, which is a huge area. But in amongst that, what you see a lot of is it's hitting the Adelaide beaches, and we're seeing a lot of dead fish. We're now up, I think, over 10,000 records in iNaturalist or thereabouts of dead animals that people have recorded over the last little while. And I believe that there is a total of 10 dolphins last time I checked, and quite a number of white pointers and bronze whalers that have been impacted by the bloom, either directly or indirectly. We think on the case of the sharks that they've been directly impacted by damage to their gills, whereas the dolphins and things, the death rates seem to be higher than normal. It might just be that people are recording them, but it does seem that they're higher than normal, and technically this bloom will only irritate them, not kill them. But as you well know, if you're going around with itchy eyes and tired and your skin's itching and all the rest, and you're struggling to find food, you're more likely to get other diseases. And so what we usually see in a bloom like this is we have more viruses and things present in the dolphins, which might be the case here.
So going back in time, can you just tell us a bit about how long this has been going on now? And has it been the same intensity over the whole time?
All right. Well, that's a very long tale, it turns out, because the earliest, myself and Janine and some of the others are really 100% comfortable with the bloom starting, is down in sort of January this year, at a place called Robe, or just north at Boatswain's Point, where one of the fishermen there started reporting skin rashes and a lack of fish and a lot of seagrass and seaweed death. That being said, there is records of strange fish kill events and algae all the way around to Portsmouth in Victoria. And so there's a lot of unknown questions around whether they tie in or not, those other ones. But the one that we're comfortable about starts at Robe, and it's a result of a marine heat wave that has caused the bonny upwelling that causes the upwelling that generates all of the food for the copepods and things for the whales. Well, it ran like crazy about a year ago as this large blob of hot water moved across the coast and has sat across our gulfs. And it is, of course, into Victoria as well. That caused the upwelling to run like crazy as it came in, and then it seems to have stopped. And it hasn't run since. It usually runs in autumn. It didn't run this summer and autumn at all, that we can tell. And that caused the waters in the nearshore environment, so where we've usually got these cold water tolerant macroalgae and seagrasses, to die. And where they didn't die, they died back. So we had a lot of rotting organic matter in the water. It's quite remarkable when you look around Robe and Cape Jaffa. Even when I went down there in April, there's this sort of brown slurry of really fine particulate dead seaweed all the way out to the end of the jetties. And there was no zooplankton or anything in the water when I went there in April, given that we believe it had been hit in January. So that's pretty severe. It wasn't documented because it's a long way from anywhere and no one was out there and no one knew what to look at. We first had it in the media in very early March when a mob of surfers got sick of it in Middleton. And then it continued to wander around the coast, following the currents, across to the York Peninsula, around Kangaroo Island, up through the Gulfs, especially Gulf St. Vincent, and now it has come back down. So it's been a four-month journey that we've had in the media, possibly 6 or 7 months on the ground that we've had this bloom happening. It has varied in intensity, and that has depended on the species that have been involved and the density, and also the stage of the bloom. So we know many of these species become more toxic in certain events, when they're short of nutrients, when they're being predated by something else. We know that many Carinia are more toxic when copepods are grazing them, or in this case, when they're being grazed by a sea sparkle that is beautiful, but it eats the Carinia. And so these are all natural environmental things with these variables. But it's been a fair old and traumatic journey for South Australia. One thing we're not very good at is working out that the scale of this, when somebody gets impacted, they think it's the end of the world for their area, and it does feel like that, but it has been experienced now along most of the coastline, and so there's a growing community recognition that this is a huge natural disaster. And then we also need to recognise this is happening worldwide, so we're seeing similar, maybe not as large, maybe not as obvious, not as publicly visible as this one, but we're seeing similar impacts of blooms. As I said, there seems to be something down in Victoria there. There's issues in New South Wales, Western Australia, New Zealand, right along this southern border of the continent. There is, when people go to sleep here, I get phone calls from places in Albania and Spain, America. All have huge blooms. America's got some really interesting and useful ways of dealing with them. But, you know, in some areas in the Mediterranean, which is a very confined sea, we're dealing with, you know, waters up to 13 degrees hotter than normal, which is mind-blowing.
It's, you know, it sounds incredibly complex and far-reaching. You've mentioned a number of different kinds of marine life already: dolphins, sharks, fish, algae, seaweeds, that kind of thing. So what kinds of marine life is this affecting?
Anything that has gills. So that's pretty much everything. So in the Coorong, it hit all of the polychaete worms and all of the bloodworms and all of the tube worms and all of those fundamental things to shorebirds, which is incredibly important in the Coorong. It also hit all of the mud cockles and the little shore crabs. And what's really disturbing around this one is it's hitting all of the seaweeds. And it turns out that this is a really strange scientific fact, is that some of the dinoflagellates, their closest relations, in fact, they're in the same family, is the giant kelp. And it seems so weird. We're dealing with something that is 20 microns across, so 20 thousandth of a millimetre across, and its closest relation is this giant, largest plant that we can imagine. And so this is quite interesting, because it means that a lot of the allopathic processes that the dinoflagellate puts out are impacting a lot of the seaweeds, and also in some cases the seagrasses. And that has meant that die-off that we had of seaweeds and seagrasses due to the heat has been made worse by the by the allopathic processes or the preventing other things from growing processes and chemicals of the Carinia micimotoi, the dinoflagellate, which is a little bit challenging because it then, of course, when you've got, I was talking to a KI, Kangaroo Island councillor from the local council there, and he almost made me cry on a webinar because he was describing how these incredible marine zones that, I mean, Kangaroo Island is just mind-blowing, right? When you go snorkeling or scuba diving there. When you go diving in some of the worst impacted areas, there is like an inch or two of organic slime that is just rotting dead fish and rotting seagrasses along the base. It's this sort of grey, mucilaginous, gross stuff. And he wanted to know if that would come back, if things would grow through that, or whether the actual physical presence of that slime would stop regrowth of the abalone, of the kelps, of everything else that was important, the sea anemones, you know. And I'm deeply concerned that often what we see when we get that sort of thick bacterial ooze left is that it is very hard for those things to reestablish. But of course, the really interesting thing is that's the dissolved organic matter that this dinoflagellate, because it's you would assume that plants photosynthesize, but in this case, dinoflagellates are what we call mixotrophs, which means that they actually eat decomposing organic matter as their preference, and bacteria and picoplankton, so little tiny, tiny, tiny things. So they engulf them, which is effectively eat. And they photosynthesize as their next order of preference. And so that's why you get a dinoflagellate bloom, is when there's lots of organic matter in the water. You get a cyanobacterial bloom if there is lots of phosphate in the water. You get a diatom bloom if there's lots of inorganic nitrogen phosphate like you get from fertilizer. And so because we've got this lot of organic matter, we're getting dinoflagellate blooms. They're mainly toxic. And what the councillor was telling us about the state of the marine waters around Kangaroo Island means that that's going to self-reinforce itself potentially.
That's really fascinating. So you're saying that these dinoflagellates, these microscopic algae, they're producing chemicals that actually kill other plants in the water, as well as attacking the gills of species that have gills on them.
Yes, that's right. It's absolutely incredible. And most plants do. If you go and stand underneath a pine tree, all of those pine needles put out chemicals that prevent other things from growing, and eucalypts are really good at it too. And so many of our plant life are really good at this process of allopathy. Some of our plants are really good at the opposite, encouraging other things to grow around them. But, yeah, we often tend to miss the fact that there's this incredibly complex life in every drop of water that you look at. And it's almost like there's this United Nations, sometimes War of the Worlds thing happening that I can see underneath my microscope. And it's incredible what we miss when we only look at those things that we see as large, complex, multi-celled human beings.
That's Faith Coleman talking about the algal bloom that has killed thousands of marine animals and plants in southern Australia this year. We'll continue talking to Faith after this. You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR. I'm talking with ecologist Faith Coleman about the devastating algal bloom that is killing thousands of marine animals and plants in South Australia.
You've already mentioned that this sort of started around a heat wave over the summer, but do we know what's causing this algal bloom at this point? Why is it continuing to go on?
Okay, so that blob of hot water that sits off the coast is still there. I know the land feels freezing, and We've got rain coming and we've had storms, but they haven't flushed the gulfs here the way they normally would. And so that organic matter persists. And this mob of, and one of the reasons that is likely, and I'm not an oceanographer, but one of the reasons I'm hearing is most likely the cause is that those, that blob of hot water is stopping those currents from moving freely in and out of the Gulf. And so without those currents, we're not flushing all of that dissolved organic matter out.
I guess it's like a heat wave over land, really. We went in summer, we get the hot air that's kind of blocked and sitting over the cities and it just won't go away. And we're waiting for a cold front to come through and it just, you know, it seems to take forever, but this is obviously going on for months and months.
Yeah, it's the forecasts are talking to the department who saw a conversation I had about needing to discuss the long term. The oceanographers have sat down and done some modelling and they suspect this may persist for another year here, which is devastating because each time it moves to a different area, every time we get a storm, it blows the worst of the bloom somewhere else. And where it has been doesn't necessarily recover. And so there's this juggle occurring. It may not be getting a bigger bloom, but it's damaging more areas. And so when we talk about it maybe persist for another year, if it doesn't clean up this winter, that we've got a problem. And initially, a lot of the government advice was that with lower temperatures, this algae would stop breeding and go away. And to a degree, that has happened, that in the fact that this sea sparkle, which is another dinoflagellate, is eating it, and that tends to only come when the water is cooler, and it tends to only come when the numbers drop down a little in density. But what we are seeing is there seems to be somehow that this algae species, or a closely related one, because we really, you know, you take 200 mils of water out of the side of the ocean and you put it under a microscope, one drop goes underneath the microscope and you're expecting that to characterise an entire gulf or a whole system, and it doesn't. Although we know there's other species in there, we don't know their dominance, and some of them need electron scanning microscopes and things to differentiate them. And most people don't have those things. At the moment, for the toxins that they're producing, we're sending them off to New Zealand to be tested because we've never had brevetoxins here before. So every time someone wants to know if their seafood is toxic, we need to send the sample to New Zealand, which seems completely improbable. And so it's one of these things. It's likely to, and we see in California, many of the blooms last 18 months to 2 years, and we just got to be prepared for that, even if it isn't.
Yeah, you've mentioned a couple of other places around the world where you're getting calls from and people wanting to know what's going on. So how significant is this event in southern Australia, in Australia, worldwide?
Okay, so for Australia, it's probably the biggest single bloom of a toxic species that we have on record. It's not the only bloom going on in Australia right now. And so the question is whether we consider them as a whole event or whether we just look at this one species here. And we tend to just look at this one species here, which is probably not representative of the situation. It is the hottest marine heat wave on record. The correlation is pretty close. And our previous large events of this species have been during years of marine heat waves. So they have occurred here before. But in comparison to what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere, this is a drop in the ocean.
Obviously, this is still an ongoing disaster. And you've mentioned, you know, how some of the information is coming through. How are scientists and researchers coming to understand what's going on?
Poorly. The problem is that our primary industries department here, PERSA, is really, really, really closely affiliated with our agriculture industry. And when I say that, I mean the larger players in the aquaculture industry that pay the largest license fees. And because of that, we have people who are working, you know, many, many days a week just to service those people, okay, those enterprises. We have a number of people in PERSA who do things like plankton counts and toxin analysis and water quality. But all of that data at the moment, even the responses to things like Fish Watch, where we ring up and we complain about dead fish, all of that data is being held commercially in confidence by our Department for Primary Industries, which as a scientist is incredibly hard, because I believe very strongly as we approach a period of uncertainty, we need to embrace things like the open data frameworks, where all data is shared freely. I think that we're all entitled to the same set of facts, even if we have a different interpretation of them. And so one of the largest challenges throughout this bloom has been a lack of sharing of data and information. I often get asked by members of our various government agencies to give them my free advice and my free analysis. They ring me up and talk to me. I will get 20, 30 phone calls from department staff a week, which I'm trying to run a business is really, really hard. I don't ring them, they ring me. And yet they find themselves unable to share their data with me. And that's not how science works. And it's not how we solve uncertain situations that are highly variable like this one. And so there's actually a group of us, there's probably six or seven of us now, independent scientists who run our own businesses. There is a toxicologist, there is a marine biologist, there is myself who does the ecology, there is people who specialise in filter feeders and community restoration works and citizen science empowering people. And we have just stepped into action, because even though the department's doing their own thing behind the scenes, the community wasn't seeing that, and so they weren't feeling that they could respond. You can't decide when to go surfing, for instance, if you don't know that it's better at some times of the day and worse at others. You can't decide that you need to start talking to someone about shifting your oyster reefs or your oyster farm, or using bentonite clays to treat the area around your fish farm, if you don't know that there is an issue or that you're not getting the data back. Because it turns out that even the smaller enterprises, the little oyster farms, the artisan fisheries in the Coorong, the even the finfish people out on the gulfs, are finding they're not getting the data that is being held commercially in confidence within the departments for their commercial interest, when they have paid for it amongst the others. But they're so small in comparison to these larger license holders that they're not getting the service that they really need right now. And so a lot of those industries seem to have entered this group of community people who have no support, that are working with this group of pro bono scientists. And that's a really weird situation to be in.
Mm. Yeah, it's it seems crazy that, you know, even the baseline response of finding out what's going on is not really there. Is there what can people do to, you know, is there anything people can do to mitigate the effects of this bloom?
The best form of cure is always prevention. Okay. And so in South Australia, I believe it's the same in your beautiful bay embayment there. We have these confined waters which are more vulnerable to plankton blooms. They're more vulnerable to changes in current causing them to become somewhat gross and warm. Melbourne is incredibly vulnerable to these effects, even more so than Adelaide. And what we've found in these coastal embayments and gulfs is that over the time since settlement, we have dredged out most of our oysters, and we've also removed our kelp, and we've also, you know, dredged channels and built farms and discharged sewage. So these embayments that were once full of benthic life, you know, 80, 90% of the sediment in them was covered by something that stopped the interaction between the soil and the water, and also filtered out all of these blooms before they started. Whereas many of these embayments and things are now down to the 10 and 20% cover. And ecology tells us that to keep clear water environments, we need 40% cover at a minimum. 60% is far better and far more stable. And so we really need, with climate change, to start discussing, because we can no longer rely on a benign climate and a benign ocean. We need to start discussing how we get these habitats back in a large scale. I know the Nature Conservancy has been doing some amazing work there. Absolutely incredible. They've been pioneering some good work. So has Ausfish and many of the other NGOs. But we need to find a way of rolling that out. So instead of doing 10 hectares here or 1 hectare here or even 100 hectares here, we need to work out how to do tens and hundreds of square kilometres of these habitats. So as community members, it's incredibly important you get involved in those initiatives. If you're one of us who is lucky enough to have some spare money, it's incredibly important to support those initiatives. But more than anything, we have to exercise our democracy and we need to ring up our local MPs and say, actually, this is a priority, because as Australians, we're brought up that the healthy place to be is the ocean and the place we go to relax, and our identity is bound up in the oceans that surround us, that cradle us, that give us our food and our oxygen. And now it looks like they're turning into hostile environments. And this was forecast in the 70s. It's no surprise. So the important thing, I think, now is that we say that this is something that as an island nation, we have to protect.
Faith, thank you so much for joining us on Out of the Blue.
You are welcome.
That was Faith Coleman, who is an estuarine scientist and consultant in South Australia, with a warning for Melbourne and our beautiful bay, but also a solution for what we can do to look after it as the climate changes. You can find today's episode and all our previous episodes on 3cr.org.au/radioblue, and you can follow our Facebook page for updates. That's all for this week. We'll be with you again next Sunday.